used to challenge me, and that I could confront a dog only by transforming myself into a dog. This was the same craziness that Petrus had talked about that day. I began to feel that I was a dog. I bared my teeth and sounded a low growl, and hatred flowed from the sounds I made. I saw the frightened face of the shepherd off to the side and could sense that the sheep were as terrified of me as they were of the dog. Legion also saw this and became fearful. Then I attacked him. It was the first time I had done this in our fight. I attacked him with my teeth and my nails, trying to bite the dog in the throat, exactly as I had feared he would do to me. Inside, I felt only a tremendous desire for victory. Nothing else was important. I threw myself on top of the animal and pressed him to the ground. He fought to free himself from the weight of my body, and he clawed at my skin, but I, too, was biting and scratching. I could sense that if he got out from under me, he would run away, and I did not want that to happen ever again. Today I was going to beat him. The animal began to show fear in his eyes. Now I was the dog, and he seemed to have been transformed into a man. My old fear was operating in him now. It was so strong that he was able to work his way out from under me, but I corralled him in the basement of one of the abandoned houses. Behind its low slate wall was the precipice, and he had no escape. Right there he was going to see the face of his death. I suddenly began to realize that there was something wrong. My thinking was becoming cloudy, and I began to see a gypsy's face with vague images dancing around it. I had turned myself into Legion. This was the source of my power. The many devils had abandoned the poor, frightened dog that a moment from now was going to fall into an abyss, and now they were in me. I felt a terrible desire to destroy the defenseless animal. "You are the prince, and they are Legion," whispered Astrain, but I did not want to be a prince, and I heard from a distance the voice of my master. He said insistently that there was a sword to be won. I had to resist for one more minute. I should not kill that dog. I looked over at the shepherd. His look confirmed what I was thinking. He, too, was now more frightened of me than of the dog. I began to feel dizzy, and the scene began to spin. I could not allow myself to faint. If I fainted now, Legion would have won. I had to find a solution. I was no longer fighting against an animal, but against the force that possessed me. I felt my legs beginning to weaken, and I leaned against a wall, but it gave way under my weight. Among the stones and bits of wood, I fell with my face in the dirt. The earth. Legion was the earth, and the fruits of the earth. The good fruits of the earth and the bad, but of the earth. His house was in the earth, and there he ruled the earth or was ruled by it. Agape exploded within me, and I dug my nails into the earth. I screamed, and the scream was the same as I had heard the first time the dog and I had met. I felt Legion pass through my body and descend into the earth. Within me was agape, and Legion did not want to be eaten by the love that consumes. This was my will, the will that had made me fight with my remaining strength against fainting. It was the will of agape residing in my soul and resisting. My entire body trembled. Legion plummeted into the earth. I began to vomit, but I felt that it was agape growing and exiting through all of my pores. My body continued to tremble, and a long time later I sensed that Legion had returned to his realm. I could feel his last vestige pass out through my fingers. I sat on the ground, wounded and exhausted, and looked at the absurd scene in front of me. A dog, bleeding and waving his tail, and a terrified shepherd staring at me.
"It must have been something you ate," said the shepherd, not wanting to believe what he had seen. "But now that you've vomited, you will feel better."
I nodded my head. He thanked me for having controlled my dog, and went on his way down the road with his sheep. Petrus appeared, but said nothing. He tore off a strip of his shirt and made a tourniquet for my leg, which was bleeding badly. He told me to check the rest of my body, and I replied that there was nothing serious.
"You look awful," he said, smiling. His good mood seemed to have returned. We can't visit the Iron Cross with you looking like that. There are probably tourists there, and they would be frightened. I didn't pay any attention to him. I got up, brushed off the dust, and saw that I could walk. Petrus suggested that I do the ram breathing exercise, and he picked up my knapsack. I did the exercise and returned once again to a sense of harmony with the world. In half an hour, I would be at the Iron Cross. And someday, Fontsabedon was going to rise from its ruins. Legion had left a lot of power there. Command and Obedience. Petrus was carrying me as we arrived at the Iron Cross. My leg wound prevented me from walking. When he realized the extent of the damage done by the dog, he decided that I should rest until the wound had healed enough for us to continue along the strange road to Santiago. Nearby there was a village that provided shelter for pilgrims, who were overtaken by nightfall before crossing the mountains, and Petrus found us two rooms in the home of a blacksmith. My haven had a small veranda, an architectural feature we hadn't seen previously along the road. From it I could see the range of mountains we would have to cross sooner or later in order to reach Santiago. I fell into bed and slept until the following day. Although I felt slightly feverish when I awoke, I also felt better. Petrus brought some water from the fountain that the villagers called the Bottomless Well, and he bathed my wounds. In the afternoon he came to my room with an old woman who lived nearby. They placed several different types of herbs in the wounds and lacerations, and the woman made me drink some bitter tea. Petrus insisted that I lick the wounds until they had completely closed. I can still remember the sweet, metallic flavor of my blood. It nauseated me, but my guide told me that my saliva was a powerful disinfectant. The fever returned during the second day. Petrus and the old woman again plied me with the tea, and they again put the herbs on my wounds. But the fever, although it was not high, continued. My guide decided to go to a military base nearby to see if he could get some bandages, since there was no place in the entire village where gauze or adhesive tape was available. Several hours later, Petrus returned with the bandages. He was accompanied by a young medical officer who insisted on knowing where the animal was that had attacked me. "From the type of bite you have, the animal was rabid," he told me. "No, no," I said. "I was just playing with him, and it got out of control. I have known the dog for a long time." The medical officer was not convinced. He insisted that I take an anti-rabies vaccine, and I was forced to let him administer at least one dose, or else I would have been transferred to the base hospital. Afterward, he again asked where the animal was. "In Fontsabedon," I answered. "Fontsabedon is a city in ruins. There are no dogs there," he said, with an air of having found out the lie. I began to moan as though I were in pain, and Petrus led the young officer out of the room. But he left everything we would need: clean bandages, adhesive tape, and a styptic compound. Petrus and the old woman refused to use the compound. They bound the wounds with gauze and herbs instead. This made me happy because it meant I would no longer have to lick the places where the dog had bitten me. During the night they both knelt at my bedside and, with their hands placed on my body, prayed aloud for me. I asked Petrus what he was doing, and he made a vague reference to the divine graces and the road to Rome. I wanted him to tell me more, but he said nothing else. 2 days later I had recuperated completely. That morning I looked out my window and saw some soldiers conducting a search of the houses nearby and of the hills around the village. I asked one of them what was happening. "There is a rabid dog somewhere around here," he answered. That afternoon the blacksmith in whose rooms we were staying came to me and asked that I leave the town as soon as I was able to travel. The story had spread among the townspeople, and they were fearful that I would become rabid and transmit the disease to others. Petrus and the old woman began to argue with the blacksmith, but he was adamant. At one point he even asserted that he had seen a trickle of foam at the corner of my mouth while I was sleeping. There was no way to convince him that all of us drool a bit in our sleep.
That night Petrus and a woman prayed incessantly over me, and the next day, limping somewhat, I was once again on the strange road to Santiago. I asked Petrus if he had been worried about my recovery. "There is an understanding about the road to Santiago that I have not told you about before," he said. "Once a pilgrimage has begun, the only acceptable excuse for interrupting it is illness. If you had not been able to recover from your wounds and your fever had continued, it would have been an omen, telling us that our pilgrimage had to end there." But he added, with some pride, that his prayers had been answered, and I was certain that the outcome had been as important for him as it was for me. The road was downhill now, and Petrus pointed out that it would be that way for the next 2 days. We had returned to our usual schedule, with a siesta every afternoon at the time when the sun was fiercest. Because of my bandages, Petrus carried my knapsack. We were no longer in a hurry. The encounter we had been rushing toward was over. My disposition improved with every hour, and I was quite proud of myself. I had climbed a waterfall and defeated the demon of the road. All that remained was the most important task, to find my sword. I mentioned this to Petrus. "Your victory was beautiful, but you failed in the most critical sense," he said, throwing a deluge of cold water over me. "What do you mean?" "Knowing the right moment for the encounter. I had to hurry us along, setting a pace that was demanding, and the only thing you could think about was that we were after your sword. What good is a sword if you don't know where you are going to run into your enemy?" "The sword is the instrument of my power," I answered. "You are too preoccupied with your power," he said. "The waterfall, the ram practices, the dialogues with your messenger, they all made you forget that there was your enemy to vanquish, and forget that you had an impending encounter with him. Before your hand can wield the sword, you have to discover where your enemy is and how to deal with him. The sword only strikes a blow, but the hand is already victorious or defeated before the blow is delivered. You defeated Legion without your sword. There is a secret in this search, and it is a secret you have not yet learned. If you do not do so, you will never find what you are looking for." I didn't answer him. Every time I began to feel that I was getting close to my objective, Petrus insisted on reminding me that I was just a simple pilgrim, and that there was always something else I needed in order to find what I was looking for. The happiness I had been feeling a few minutes before we began the conversation now disappeared completely. Once again I was starting out on the strange road to Santiago, and I was totally discouraged. Along the same road that I was walking, millions of souls had passed during the past 12 centuries, going to and returning from Santiago de Compostela. In their case, going to where they had wanted to go had only been a matter of time. In my case, the traps set by the tradition were forever placing another obstacle in my path and creating new tests for me. I told Petrus that I was growing tired, and we sat down in the shade. There were huge wooden crosses along the side of the road. Petrus put the 2 knapsacks on the ground and spoke again. "Our enemy always represents our weaker side. This may be a fear of physical pain, but it may also be a premature sense of victory, or the desire to abandon the fight because we define it as not being worth the effort. Our enemy joins the battle only because he knows that he can hurt us, and hurt us in exactly the spot where our pride tells us that we are most invincible. During the fight, we always try to protect our weak spot, so the enemy strikes at the unguarded side, the side in which we have the most confidence. And we wind up defeated because we allow what should never have been allowed. We let the enemy choose how the battle will be waged." Everything Petrus was describing had happened during my fight with the dog. Yet I told him that I could not accept the idea that I had enemies, and that I had to do battle with them. I said that when Petrus had spoken of the good fight, I had thought that he had been talking about fighting for achievements in one's life. "That's right," he said, "but that's not all the good fight is. Going to war is not a sin. It is an act of love. The enemy develops us and sharpens us, as the dog did with you. Okay, I understand that. But let's get back to what we were talking about before. Why is it that you never seem to be satisfied with what I do? I have the impression that you always think I'm going about things the wrong way. And weren't you about to tell me the secret of my sword? Petrus said that this was something I should have learned before beginning the pilgrimage, and he went on about the enemy. Our enemy is part of agape, there to test our grip, our will, and our handling of the sword. He was placed in our lives, and we in his, with a purpose. And that purpose has to be met. So to flee from the battle is the worst thing that could happen. It is worse than losing the fight, because we can always learn something from defeat. If we flee, all we do is declare that our enemy has won. I said I was surprised to hear him say that. It amazed me to hear a man who seemed to feel so close to Jesus talk about violence in this way. Think about why Jesus needed Judas so, he said. He had to choose an enemy, or his battle here on earth could not have been glorified. The wooden crosses along the road testified to how that glory had been achieved, with blood, treason, and desertion. I got up and said I was ready to move on. As we walked, I asked him what, in a battle situation, was a person's greatest source of strength in trying to defeat the enemy. You're present. We defend ourselves best through what we are doing right now, because that is where agape and the will to win, through enthusiasm, are. And there's another thing I want to make very clear. The enemy rarely represents evil. He's an everyday presence, and it is he that keeps our sword from rusting in its scabbard. I remembered that once, when we were building a summer house, my wife had decided suddenly to change the location of one of the rooms. It had been my job to give this disagreeable news to the builder. I had called him, a man of about 70 years of age, and told him what I wanted. He had looked at the plan, thought about it, and come up with an even better solution, using a wall that he had already begun to raise. My wife had loved the idea. Maybe it was this that Petrus was trying to describe in a more complicated way, that we have to use the thrust of what we are doing right now to defeat the enemy. I told him the story about the builder. Life always teaches us more than the road to Santiago does, he answered. But we don't have much faith in what life teaches us. There were crosses all along this part of the Jacobean route. They were made of such massive, heavy wood that the pilgrim who put them there must have had an almost superhuman strength. A cross had been placed every 30 meters for as far as I could see. I asked Petrus what their significance was. An ancient and obsolete instrument of torture, he said. But why are they here? They must have been some kind of pledge. How should I know? We stopped in front of one of them that had toppled over. Maybe the wood rotted, I said. It's the same wood as all the others, and none of the others rotted. Then it must not have been sunk into the earth firmly enough. Petrus stopped and looked around. He put his knapsack on the ground and sat down. We had stopped to rest only a few minutes before, so I couldn't understand what he was doing. Instinctively, I looked around, expecting to see the dog. You defeated the dog, he said, knowing what I was thinking. Don't worry about the ghosts of the dead. Well, then why are we stopping? Petrus made a gesture that told me to be quiet, and I did not say anything for several minutes. I felt the old fear of the dog and decided to remain standing, hoping Petrus would say something. What are you here? He asked me. Nothing. The silence. We are not smart enough to be able to listen to the silence. We're just human beings. We don't even know how to listen to our own ramblings. You have never asked me how I knew that Legion was about to arrive. Now I will tell you how. By listening.
The sound began many days before, when we were still in Astorga. Starting then, I began to move along more quickly, because all the indications were that we were going to meet up with him in Fontsabadon. You heard the same sound as I, but you were not listening. Everything is contained in sounds, the past, the present, the future. The person who does not know how to listen will never hear the advice that life offers us all the time. And only the person who listens to the sounds of the moment is able to make the right decisions. Petrus bade me sit down and forget about the dog. He said that he was going to teach me one of the easiest and most important practices of the road to Santiago. And he explained the listening exercise to me. "Do it right now," he said. I began to perform the exercise. I heard the wind and a woman's voice far in the distance, and at one point I sensed that a branch was being broken. It was not a difficult exercise, and I was fascinated by its simplicity. I put my ear to the ground and began to listen to the muted sounds of the earth. After a few moments I began to separate the sounds from each other, the sound of the leaves rustling, the sound of the voice in the distance, and the noise of the beating of the wings of birds. An animal grunted, but I could not identify what kind of beast it was. The 15 minutes I spent on the exercise flew by. The listening exercise. Relax. Close your eyes. Try for several minutes to concentrate on all of the sounds you hear in your surroundings, as if you were hearing an orchestra playing its instruments. Little by little, try to separate each sound from the others. Concentrate on each one, as if it were the only instrument playing. Try to eliminate the other sounds from your awareness. When you do this exercise every day, you will begin to hear voices. First, you will think that they are imaginary. Later, you will discover that they are voices of people from your past, present, and future, all of them participating with you in the remembrance of time. This exercise should be performed only when you already know the voice of your messenger. Do this exercise for 10 minutes at a time. After a while, you will see that this exercise will help you to make the right decision, Petrus said, without asking me what I had heard. Agape speaks to you through the blue sphere exercise, but it also speaks to you through your sight, your sense of touch, through sense, and your heart, and your hearing. A week from now, at the most, you will begin to hear voices. At first, they will be timid, but before long they're going to begin to tell you things that are important. Be careful, though, with your messenger. He is going to try to confuse you. However, you already know the sound of his voice, so he will no longer be a threat. Petrus asked if I had heard the joyful call of an enemy, or an invitation offered by a woman, or the secret of my sword. I just heard the voice of a woman in the distance, I said. But it was a farmer's wife calling out to her child. But look at that cross there. And see if you can raise it with your thoughts. I asked him what such an exercise would mean. It means having faith in your thoughts, he responded. I sat down on the ground in a yoga position. I was certain that after everything I had accomplished with the dog and with the waterfall, I was going to be able to do this, too. I fixated on the cross. I imagined myself leaving my body, grasping the cross, and raising it using my astral body. On the road of the tradition, I had already performed some of these small miracles. I had been able to shatter glasses and porcelain statues and to move objects along the surface of a table. It was an easy magic trick, and even though it did not signify any great power, it was useful in winning over non-believers. I had never tried it, though, with an object the size and weight of the cross. But if Petrus had commanded that I do so, I felt I would know how to make it happen. For a half hour I tried everything I could. I used astral displacement and suggestion.
I remembered the power my master had over the force of gravity, and I tried to repeat the words that he always used on such occasions. Nothing happened. I was concentrating completely, but the cross did not budge. I invoked Astrain, and he appeared between the columns of fire, but when I spoke to him about the cross, he said that he detested crosses. Petrus finally shook me to bring me out of my trance. "Come on, this is becoming irritating," he said. "Since you can't do it by thinking, put the cross upright with your hands."
"With my hands?"
"Do it!" I was startled. Suddenly the man in front of me had become nasty, very different from the person who had cared for my wounds. I didn't know what to say or do.
"Do it," he repeated.
"I am ordering you to do it." There I was, with my arms and hands wrapped in bandages because of the dog's attack. I had just been through the listening exercise, but I couldn't believe what I was hearing from Petrus. Without saying anything, I showed him my bandages, but he continued to look coldly at me, not changing his expression in the least. He expected me to obey him. The guide and friend who had accompanied me all this time, who had taught me the ram practices and told me the beautiful stories about the road to Santiago, seemed no longer to be there. In his place I saw a man who regarded me as a slave and had ordered me to do something that was stupid.
"What are you waiting for?"
he asked. I remembered the waterfall experience. I recalled that on that day I had had some doubts about Petrus, but that then he had been generous with me. He had demonstrated his love and had kept me from giving up on my sword. I could not understand how the same person who had been so kind could be so harsh now. He suddenly seemed to represent the very thing that the human race was trying to put behind it, the oppression of one person by another.
"Petrus, I do it, or the road to Santiago ends right here."
I was scared again. At that moment I was more frightened than I had been at the waterfall. I was more fearful of him than of the dog that had terrorized me for so long. I prayed that a signal would come to me from somewhere in our surroundings, that I would see or hear something that would explain his senseless command, but we were engulfed in silence. I had either to obey Petrus or forget about the sword. Once again I raised my bandaged arms, but he sat down on the ground, waiting for me to carry out his orders. So I decided to obey him. I went to the cross and tried to budge it with my foot to test its weight. It hardly moved. Even if my hands had been in good shape, I would have had a very difficult time trying to lift it, and I knew that with my hands bound as they were, the task would be almost impossible. But I was going to comply. I was going to die in the attempt if that was necessary. I was going to sweat blood as Jesus had when he had had to carry the same kind of burden. But Petrus was going to perceive the seriousness of my effort, and perhaps that would touch him in some way, and he would free me from the test. The cross had broken at its base, but it was still attached to it. I had no knife with which to cut through the fibers. Forgetting about my pain, I put my arms around the cross and tried to wrench it from the shattered base without using my hands. The wood abraded the lacerations on my arms, and I cried out in pain. I looked at Petrus, and he was completely impassive. I resolved that I would not cry out again. From that moment on, I would stifle any such demonstration. I knew that my immediate problem was not to move the cross, but to free it from its base. Afterward, I would have to dig a hole and push the cross into it. I found a stone with an edge to it, and ignoring the pain, began to pound at the wooden fibers. The pain was terrible and grew worse with every blow, and the fibers were parting very slowly. I had to give up that approach right away before my wounds reopened and the whole effort became impossible. I decided to work at it more slowly so that I could accomplish the task without succumbing to the pain. I took off my shirt, wrapped it around my hand, and went back to the job with this additional protection. The idea was a good one, The first fiber parted, then the second. The stone was losing its edge, so I looked around for another. Each time I paused, I had the feeling that I would not be able to start again. I gathered several sharp stones and used them, one after the other, so that the pain in the hand I was working with was bearable. Almost all of the fibers had been cut, but the main one still held firm. The pain in my hand was increasing, and abandoning the idea of working slowly, I began to strike at the wood frantically. I knew that I was coming close to the point where the pain would make it impossible to continue. It was just a matter of time until this happened, and I had to make good use of that time. I was sawing and pounding now, and something sticky between my skin and the bandages was making the work even more difficult. It is probably blood, I thought, but then I put it out of my mind. I gritted my teeth, struck harder at the fiber, and it seemed about to break. I was so excited that I stood up and delivered a blow with all my strength to the wood that was causing all my suffering. With a groan, the cross fell to the side, freed from its base. My joy lasted only for a few moments. My hand was throbbing violently, and I had only begun the job. I looked over at Petrus and saw that he was sleeping. I stood there for a time, trying to figure out some way of fooling him, of putting the cross upright without his noticing it. But that was exactly what Petrus wanted, that I raise the cross. And there was no way to deceive him, because the task depended solely on me. I looked at the ground, the dry, yellow earth. Once again, stones would be my only tools. I could not work any more with my right hand because it hurt too much, and there was that sticky substance under the bandage that worried me. I carefully unwrapped the shirt from the bandages. Blood was staining the gauze, and this was a wound that had almost healed. Petrus was a monster. I found a different kind of stone, one that was heavier and more resistant. Rolling the shirt around my left hand, I began to beat at the earth, trying to dig a hole at the foot of the cross. My initial progress was good, but it was soon slowed by the hardness and dryness of the ground. I kept digging, but the hole seemed to stay at the same depth. I decided I would not make the hole very wide so that the cross would fit into it without wobbling, but this made it more difficult to remove the dirt from the excavation. My right hand had stopped hurting as much as it had, but the coagulated blood made me nauseated and anxious. I was not used to working with my left hand, and the stone kept slipping from my grip. I dug forever. Every time the stone beat on the ground, and every time I put my hand into the hole to remove some dirt, I thought of Petrus. I looked over at him, dozing peacefully, and I hated him from the bottom of my heart. Neither the noise nor my hatred appeared to disturb him. "He must have his reasons," I said to myself. But I could not understand the debasement and humiliation he was inflicting on me. I saw his face in the earth I was pounding, and the rage I was feeling helped me to dig the hole deeper. Again, it was just a matter of time. Sooner or later, I was going to win. As I thought about this, the rock hit something solid and sprang back. This was my worst fear. After all that work, I had run into a stone that was too big for me to continue. I stood up, wiping the sweat from my face, and began to think. I didn't have enough strength to move the cross to another place. I couldn't start again from the beginning because my left hand, now that I had stopped, felt dead. This was worse than pain, and it really scared me. I looked at my fingers, and I was able to move them, but instinct told me that I shouldn't punish the hand any more. I looked at the hole. It wasn't deep enough to hold the cross erect. "The wrong answer will indicate the right one." I remembered the shadows exercise and what Petrus had said then. It was also then that he had told me that the ram practices would make sense only if I could apply them in my daily life. Even in a situation as absurd as the present one, the ram practices should be of some use. "The wrong answer will indicate the right one." The impossible solution would be to try to drag the cross to a different place. I no longer had the strength to do that. It was also impossible to try digging deeper into the ground. So if the impossible answer was to go deeper into the earth, the possible answer was to raise the earth. But how? And suddenly, all of my love for Petrus was restored. He was right. I could raise the earth. I began to collect all the stones nearby and place them around the hole, mixing them with the earth I had removed. With great effort, I lifted the foot of the cross a little and supported it with stones to raise it higher off the ground. In half an hour, the ground was higher and the hole was deep enough. Now I had just to get the cross into the hole. It was the last step, and I had to make it work. One of my hands was numb, and the other was giving me a great deal of pain. My arms were wrapped in bandages, but my back was all right. It had just a few scratches. If I could lie down beneath the cross and raise it bit by bit, I would be able to slide it into the hole. I stretched out on the ground, feeling the dust in my nose and eyes. With the hand that was numb, I raised the cross a fraction and slid underneath it. Carefully, I adjusted my position so that its trunk rested squarely on my back. I felt its weight and knew that it would be heavy to lift, but not impossible. I thought about the seed exercise, and very slowly I squirmed into a fetal position, balancing the cross on my back. Several times I thought it was going to fall, but I was working slowly. I was able to sense the direction it might take and correct for it by repositioning my body. I finally achieved the position I wanted, with my knees in front of me and the cross balanced. For a moment the foot of the cross shook on the pile of stones, but it did not fall out of place. "It's a good thing I don't have to save the universe," I thought, oppressed by the weight of the cross and everything it represented. A profoundly religious feeling took possession of me. I remembered that another person had carried the cross on his shoulders and that his damaged hands had not been able to free themselves from the wood or the pain as mine could. This religious feeling was loaded down with pain, but I forgot about it immediately because the cross began to shake again. Then, slowly raising myself up, I began a rebirth. I couldn't look behind me, and sound was my only means of orientation. But just a while ago I had learned how to listen to the world, as if Petrus had guessed that I was going to need this kind of knowledge. I felt the weight of the cross and sensed that the stones were accommodating each other. The cross rose bit by bit as if to help me in this test. It was as if the cross itself wanted to return to its position, framing that section of the road to Santiago. One final push was all that was needed. If I could get into a seated position, the trunk of the cross would slide down my back into the hole. One or two of the stones had been dislodged, but the cross was now helping me, since its foot remained in place where I had built up the wall. Finally, a pull on my back indicated that the base was free. It was the final moment, just as at the waterfall when I had had to fight my way through the current. The most difficult moment, because it is then that we fear failure and want to give up before it occurs. Once again I sensed how absurd the task was, trying to raise a cross when all I really wanted to do was find my sword, but none of these thoughts was important. With a sudden thrust, I raised my back, and the cross slid into place. At that moment I recognized once again that fate had been directing the work I had done. I stood there, expecting the cross to fall in the other direction, scattering the stones I had placed. Then I thought that maybe my push had not been strong enough, and that the cross was going to fall back on top of me. But what I heard was the muffled sound of something hitting against the bottom of the hole. I turned carefully. The cross was upright, and it was still trembling from the impact. Some stones were rolling down their slope, but the cross was not going to fall. I quickly put the stones back in place and embraced the cross so that it would stop wavering. I felt alive and hot, certain that the cross had been my friend throughout all my work. I stepped away slowly, improving the placement of the stones with my feet. I stood there admiring my work for a long time, until my wounds began to hurt. Petrus was still asleep. I went over to him and nudged him with my foot. He awoke with a start and looked at the cross. "Very good," was all that he had said. "In Ponferrada we will change the bandages." The Tradition. I would rather have lifted a tree. That cross on my back had me thinking that my search for wisdom was going to be the death of me. Looking at my surroundings, my words rang a bit hollow. The cross episode was already history, as if it had happened a long time ago, and not just the previous day. It had no relation to the black marble bathroom, the warmth of the water in the hot tub, or the crystal goblet of Rioja wine that I was enjoying. I could not see Petrus, who was in his own bedroom in the luxury suite we had rented in a first-class hotel. "Why the cross?" I insisted. "It wasn't easy to convince the man at the front desk that you weren't a beggar," he yelled from his room. He was changing the subject, and I knew from experience that it would do no good to press the matter. I got up and put on trousers, a clean shirt, and fresh bandages. I had removed the old ones very carefully, expecting to find open wounds, but the scabs had only broken away from the skin slightly and allowed some blood to ooze out. A new scab had already formed, and I was feeling restored and happy. We had dinner at the hotel restaurant. Petrus asked for the specialty of the house, a Valencia paella, which we ate in silence. After dinner, he suggested a walk. We left the hotel and walked in the direction of the railroad station. He was in his now habitual laconic state and said nothing throughout our entire stroll. We came to a train yard, filthy and smelling of oil, and he sat down on the steps of a gigantic locomotive. "Let's stop here," he said. I didn't want to get oil stains on my pants, so I decided to stand. I asked him if he wouldn't prefer to walk to the main square of Ponferrada. "The road to Santiago is about to end," said my guide. "And since our reality is a lot more similar to these railroad cars, stinking of oil, than to the bucolic retreats we have encountered during our journey, it is better that today's conversation happen here." Petrus told me to take off my sneakers and my shirt. Then he loosened the bandages on my arms, leaving them freer to move. But he left those on my hands as they were. "Don't worry," he said. "You are not going to need your hands for this, at least not to hold anything." He was more serious than usual, and his tone of voice surprised me. Something important was about to happen. Petrus sat down again on the steps of the locomotive and looked at me for a long time. Then he said, "I am not going to say anything about yesterday's episode. You will discover for yourself what it means, and this will happen only if some day you decide to walk the road to Rome, the road of the graces and miracles. I want to tell you just one thing. People who consider themselves to be wise are often indecisive when command is called for, and rebellious when they are called upon to obey. They are ashamed to give orders and consider it dishonorable to receive them. Don't ever be that way. In the room, you said that the path to wisdom leads to sacrifice. That is wrong. Your learning period did not end yesterday. You still have to find your sword and learn its secret. Ram practices allow us to engage in the good fight and to have a better chance at winning in life. The experience you had yesterday was only one of the tests along the road. It was part of the preparation for the road to Rome. It saddens me that you thought it might have been the death of you." He really sounded saddened. I realized that throughout all the time we had spent together, I had always expressed doubt regarding what he was teaching me. I was not a strong, humble Castaneda receiving his teachings from Don Juan. I was an arrogant and fractious man in my approach to the simple Ram practices. I wanted to say this to Petrus, but I knew that it was too late. "Close your eyes," Petrus said.
Do the ram breathing exercise and try to harmonize yourself with this iron, this machinery, and this smell of oil. This is our world. You should open your eyes only when I have completed teaching you an exercise.
I closed my eyes, concentrated on the ram breathing, and felt my body begin to relax. I could hear the noises of the city, some dogs barking in the distance, and the sound of voices in argument not far from where we were. Suddenly I began to hear Petrus's voice singing an Italian song recorded by Peppino di Capri that had been a hit when I was a teenager. I didn't understand the words, but the melody brought back happy memories and helped me to reach a state of tranquility. "Some time ago," he began when he had stopped singing, "as I was working on a project that I had to deliver to the mayor's office in Milan, I received a message from my master. Someone had gone all the way to the end of the road of tradition, and had not received his sword. I was supposed to guide him along the road to Santiago." I was not surprised at this. I had been expecting such a summons at any time, because I had not yet paid my dues. I had to guide a pilgrim along the Milky Way just as I had once been guided. But I was nervous, because it was the first and only time that I would do this, and I did not know how to carry out my mission. Petrus's words really surprised me. I thought that he had been a guide dozens of times. "You came here, and I guided you," he continued. "I must confess that in the beginning it was very hard, because you were much more interested in the intellectual implications of the teachings than in the true meaning of the road of the common people. After the encounter with Alfonso, we developed a much stronger, more intense relationship, and I began to believe that I would be able to teach you the secret of your sword. But this did not happen. And now you will have to learn it for yourself, during the little time you have left."
This conversation was making me nervous, and I was losing my concentration on the ram breathing exercise. Petrus must have noticed, because he began to sing the song again, and stopped only when I was once again relaxed. "If you discover the secret and find your sword, you will also discover the face of Ram, and you will have the power. But that is not all. In order to achieve total wisdom, you will have to walk the other three roads, including the secret one. And the secret road will not be revealed to you, even by someone who has walked it. I am telling you this because we are going to see each other only one more time." My heart stopped, and involuntarily I opened my eyes. Petrus was glowing with the kind of brilliance I had only seen around my master. "Close your eyes," he barked, and I immediately obeyed. But I was very upset, and I could not concentrate any more. My guide started to sing the Italian song again, and only after a while was I able to relax. "Tomorrow you are going to receive a note telling you where I am. I will be at a group initiation, a ritual of honor in the tradition. It is a ritual in honor of all the men and women who, down through the centuries, have helped to keep alive the flame of wisdom, of the good fight, and of agape. You will not be able to speak to me. The place where we will meet is secret. It is bathed in the blood of all those who have walked the road of the tradition, and who, even with their swords sharpened, were unable to brighten the darkness. But their sacrifice was not in vain, and the proof that it was not is that centuries later those who have walked different roads will be there to pay them tribute. This is important, and you should never forget it. Even if you become a master, you have to realize that your road is only one of many that lead to God. Jesus once said, 'In my Father's house there are many mansions.'" Petrus repeated that after tomorrow, I would not see him again. On some future day, You will receive a message from me, asking you to lead someone along the road to Santiago, just as I have led you. Then you will be able to experience the great secret of the journey, a secret that I am going to reveal to you now, but only through words. It is a secret that has to be experienced to be understood. There was a prolonged silence. I began to think that he had changed his mind or that he had left the train yard. I felt an enormous desire to open my eyes to see what was happening, but I forced myself to concentrate on the ram breathing. "The secret is the following," Petrus said. "You can learn only through teaching. We have been together here on the road to Santiago, but while you were learning the practices, I learned the meaning of them. In teaching you, I truly learned. By taking on the role of guide, I was able to find my own true path. If you succeed in finding your sword, you will have to teach the road to someone else. And only when that happens, when you accept your role as a master, will you learn all the answers you have in your heart. Each of us knows the answers, even before someone tells us what they are. Life teaches us lessons every minute, and the secret is to accept that only in our daily lives can we show ourselves to be as wise as Solomon and as powerful as Alexander the Great. But we become aware of this only when we are forced to teach others and to participate in adventures as extravagant as this one has been." I was hearing the most unexpected farewell in my life. The person with whom I had had the most intense bond was saying goodbye right there in mid-journey, in an oily-smelling train yard, with me forced to keep my eyes closed. "I don't like saying goodbye," Petrus continued. "I am Italian, and I am very emotional. But according to the law of the tradition, you must find your sword alone. This is the only way that you will believe in your own power. I have passed on to you everything that I have to give. The only thing left is the dance exercise, which I am going to teach you now. You should perform it tomorrow at the ritual." He was silent for a while, and then he spoke. "May that which is glorified be glorified in the Lord. You may open your eyes." Petrus was still sitting on the locomotive. I did not want to say anything, because I am Brazilian and also emotional. The mercury lamp providing us with light began to flutter, and a train whistled in the distance, announcing its next stop. It was then that Petrus taught me the dance exercise. The dance exercise. Relax. Close your eyes. Recall the first songs you heard as a child. Begin to sing them in your thoughts. Little by little, let a certain part of your body, your feet, your stomach, your hands, your head, and so on, but only one part, begin to dance to the melody you are singing. After 5 minutes, stop singing and listen to the sounds all around you. Compose an internal melody based on them, and dance to it with your whole body. Don't think about anything in particular, but try to memorize the images that spontaneously appear. The dance offers an almost perfect means of communication with the infinite intelligence. This exercise should last 15 minutes. "One more thing," he said, looking deeply into my eyes. "When I completed my pilgrimage, I painted a beautiful, immense picture that depicted everything that had happened to me here. This is the road of the common people, and you can do the same thing if you like. If you don't know how to paint, write something, or create a ballet. Then, regardless of where they are, people will be able to walk the Jacobean route, the Milky Way, the strange road to Santiago." The train that had sounded its whistle began to enter the station. Petrus waved to me and disappeared between the parked railroad cars. I stood there amid the noise of brakes screeching on steel, trying to decipher the mysterious Milky Way over my head.
those stars that had guided me here, and that had silently watched over the loneliness and destiny of all human beings. The next day there was just a note left in my room. 7 p.m. Castle of the Templars. I spent the rest of that afternoon walking around the streets aimlessly. I crossed and recrossed the small city of Ponferrada, looking from a distance at the castle on the hill where I had been bidden to appear. The Templars had always stirred my imagination, and the castle in Ponferrada was not the only mark made on the Jacobean route by their order. The order had been created by 9 knights who had decided not to return from the Crusades. Within a short time, their power had spread throughout Europe, and they had caused a revolution in the values at the beginning of this millennium. While most of the nobility of the time was concerned only with enriching itself through the labor of the serfs, the Knights Templar dedicated their lives, their fortunes, and their swords to one cause only, the protection of the pilgrims that walked the road to Jerusalem. In the behavior of the knights, the pilgrims found a model for their own search for wisdom. In 1118, when Hugh de Payen and 8 other knights held a meeting in the courtyard of an old abandoned castle, they took a vow of love for all humanity. 2 centuries later, there were more than 5,000 benefices spread throughout the known world. They reconciled 2 activities that until then had appeared to be incompatible, the military life and the religious one. Donations from the members and from grateful pilgrims allowed the Order of the Knights Templars to accumulate incalculable wealth, which was used more than once to ransom important Christians who had been kidnapped by the Muslims. The honesty of the knights was such that kings and nobles entrusted their valuables to the Templars and traveled only with a document that attested to the existence of their wealth. This document could be redeemed at any castle of the Order of the Templars for an equivalent sum, giving rise to the letter of credit that is used today. Their spiritual devotion, in turn, had allowed the Knights Templars to understand the great truth that Petrus had quoted the night before, that the house of the Lord has many mansions. They sought to put an end to religious conflict and to unite the main monotheistic religions of the time, Christian, Jewish, and Islamic. Their chapels were built with the rounded cupola of the Judaic temples of Solomon, the octagonal walls of the Arab mosques, and the naves that were typical of Christian churches. But as with everything that happens before its time, the Templars came to be viewed with suspicion. The great kings sought to hold economic power, and religious liberalism was regarded as a threat to the church. On Friday, October 13th, 1307, the Vatican and the major European states unleashed one of the most massive police operations of the Middle Ages. During the night, the main leaders of the Templars were seized in their castles and thrown in prison. They were accused of practicing secret ceremonies, including the worship of the devil, of blasphemy against Jesus Christ, of orgiastic rituals, and of engaging in sodomy with their apprentices. Following a violent sequence of torture, renunciation, and treason, the Order of the Templars was erased from the map of medieval history. Their treasures were confiscated and their members scattered throughout the world. The last master of the order, Jacques de Molay, was burned at the stake in the center of Paris along with a fellow knight. His last request was that he be allowed to die looking at the towers of the Cathedral of Notre Dame. Spain, which was struggling to recapture the Iberian Peninsula, welcomed the knights fleeing from other parts of Europe, and the Spanish kings sought their help in the battles against the Moors. These knights were absorbed into the Spanish orders, one of which was the Order of Santiago of the Sword, responsible for protection along the road. I was thinking about this history when, exactly at 7 in the evening, I passed through the main gate of the old castle of the Templars of Ponferrada, where I was scheduled for an encounter with the tradition. There was no one there. I waited for half an hour, and then began to fear the worst, that the ritual must have been at 7 a.m. But just as I was deciding to leave, 2 boys appeared, carrying the flag of Holland and with the scallop shell, the symbol of the road to Santiago, sewn to their clothing. They came up to me and we exchanged some words, concluding that we were there for the same purpose. I was relieved that the note had not been wrong. Every 15 minutes someone else arrived. There were an Australian, 5 Spaniards, and another man from Holland. Other than a few questions about the schedule, about which everyone was confused, we did not talk at all. We all sat together in the same part of the castle, a ruined atrium that had served as a storeroom for food in ancient times, and we decided to wait until something happened, even if we had to wait another day and night. The waiting went on, and we felt